Among Volker Schlondorf's many films is an adaptation of The Tin Drum, based on Günter Grass's novel about a boy living in Danzig between the two world wars. A digitally restored director's cut containing about 20 minutes of new footage is making its U.S. theatrical premiere at Film Forum starting today and continuing until September 27th. And at 1 p.m. this Sunday, a documentary of Mr. Schlondorf's called Billy, How Did You Do It? Will be shown at Film Forum. It features his conversations with the great filmmaker Billy Wilder. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Volker Schlondorf back to our show today.
Hello. Hello.
The original 1979 version of The Tin Drum, which is around 2.25 hours long, was the first German movie to win an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Billy Wilder told you, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So, because you were thinking about changing it, why did you decide to add these 20 minutes of footage now?
Well, I had let it rest as is because it was so successful. And 2 years ago, I got a phone call from a lab, you know, where all the negatives are stored. And they said, we have, you know, like 180,000 feet of your original negative here. We're closing down like all the laboratories today and the film labs. And do you have any claim or can we dispose of it? And I said, oh, my God. And it came back to me that the original cut of the movie had been 2 hours and 40, as it is now again, and that due to our contract with the distributor, United Artists, we could not exceed 2 hours 15.
So I had to cut that out.
Before it was even released, you know, because, I mean, when they received the picture, they said, it's too long, you got to cut that out. And that was because at the time, you know, you had an 8 o'clock show and a 10 o'clock show, and pictures were not supposed to be much longer than 2 hours. And when we had the Golden Palm in Cannes before the Oscar, I turned to the producers and I said, well, certainly now, you know, with so much success, we can show the full-length version. And they went, are you crazy? Don't you ever even mention that? You know, it would look like you got the Oscar and didn't deserve it and the Palm because this was not the real film. You shut up and never, ever mention it again. And that's what I did for 30 years or so until this call from the lab came and I couldn't resist to restore it. It's not a director's cut. It's just the complete original cut.
Oh, so this is a restoration. There weren't scenes that you had shot that you looked at now and said, gee, we should have included that as well.
Well, I was certainly surprised when I saw those scenes that had been deleted. You know, how vivid they were and how could we ever, ever accept to cut it out?
It could have been as long as Greed or something in the original version.
No. It was, I mean, we were very contained with Jean-Claude Carrière, the screenwriter, you know, bringing the book, you know, this huge thing of 600 and more pages down to a screenplay was a hard work, and that's what we meant to stuck with.
Didn't many people think that the novel was unfilmable? Why were you willing
to
tackle?
I thought so, to start with. And it was the click was a lunch I had with Bertrand Tavernier, you know, he's a mm-hmm. school pal, going back to our school days in Paris.
A wonderful French
director, and Bertrand said, well, why are you making this movie? I mean, about a dwarf? I mean, what is your focus audience? You know, how many dwarfs are there in an audience who can identify with it? And I said, come on, you know, don't be stupid. This is about the child in every one of us, and it's just the child that doesn't want to grow up. And at that moment, I understood that indeed it was about a child, because the way the novel was written, I had envisioned a dwarf, indeed, one of those circus dwarfs, you know. And that's where I thought, well, then it's feasible.
And it's about a child who wills himself at the age of 3 not to grow
that
up.
That is the story.
And he gets older and older, and he
in all other ways.
He remains
grown.
His physical, yes,
I mean,
appearance.
he goes through puberty, but he still looks like a little child.
Of course, you couldn't take a three-year-old child. He wouldn't be able to act. But the miracle was that we came upon this child, actually son of an actor whom I well knew, Heinz Behnend, who had worked with Bergman and many others, and Truffaut, The Last Metro. And his son, at age 10, when I met him, had about the size of a six-year-old in the face of a 100-year-old and whatever. I mean, the capacity of any great actor.
And he turns out to be a great actor.
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely fabulous. And there is a monologue he does straight into the camera, which actually is kind of so important because this is how the voiceover is introduced into the movie. You know, like Billy Wilder used to ask me, who's talking into my ears there? And we didn't dare to have this in the movie. It was not so much full length. We thought, you know, an actor is never supposed to address the audience directly by looking into the camera. And he does that. And he has, you know, a 1.5 minute long monologue straight into the camera without once blinking with his eyes. I was amazed when we saw this material.
Do you think it's because his father was an actor that he understood the process? Or is this
just
a cue?
Yes, the mother was a dancer. His older sister is an actress, and we all remained like friends and family ever since. You know, he was so much an actor that when, after the first meeting with me, he came home that night, he told his dad, "Daddy, I have a part as you never had and never will get one."
What became of him?
He is still an
actor.
He was
in a film you made in 2007.
Yeah, I made a movie with him a few years ago in Kazakhstan. It hasn't opened in this country, unfortunately. David finished somehow schooling and so, but then joined for almost 20 years Peter Brook's company in Paris at the Bouffe du Nord. And he was here in New York at the BAM with The Man Who. He was the main character in that Peter Brook production. He did Shakespeare, he did everything, and he's still an incredibly intense actor.
Do you think that you could have made this film today with the scenes that were so controversial? Oscar, the boy never grows up, is supposed to be 16. He's played by a 12-year-old actor who looks six, and it's suggested that he's having sex with a number of women, including a teenage girl who's played by a 24-year-old, causing a lot of trouble. In fact, getting the film banned for a time in Oklahoma.
That's right. There is nothing politically correct in this movie. I mean, maybe I don't even know if it's morally correct and what's the difference. Probably it would not be possible anymore. I mean, I'm shocked when I see it now, but when you're young, you know, you do all kind of things and you think it's just a movie.
Now, Gunter Grass didn't allow the book to be filmed for 20 years, and then he saw your adaptation. But when he saw the first draft, he said he thought it was too Protestant and Cartesian. Was that because you were living in France and it was too Cartesian?
Well, because my screenwriter was Jean-Claude Carrière, and he's the least Cartesian of the French writers since he worked with Buñuel mostly. We had, how should I say, put some order into it, which is the first thing you need in a screenplay. Then you can go wild in the staging and in the shooting again. But you know, just to get it straight, and that he was shocked by. So it encouraged us to become a little more irrational in it. And apparently the balance is just right.
It takes place in Danzig, now Gdansk in Poland. Then a free city because Germany and Poland had claims on it.
Yeah. Well, it was like Sarajevo. It was a multicultural and, in this case, even politically independent city where you had, a Polish post office against a German post office, which is very important in the movie, and you had schools of both languages and so on. And for a while, that equilibrium held. And then the Nazis, you know, came in and say, yeah, but this is a German city. And actually, the first shots of the Second World War, September 1st, as be seen and lived in with the movie happened in Gdańsk, like that it, where it all unfortunately started and ends in a sense.
And Oscar is the son of either a Polish man or a German who becomes a Nazi.
He has a double paternity and not even and his mother. At least she claims that it's not. Even though he says, looking at his Polish father, you know, look at our eyes. That was not in the original cut, by the way. You know, this blue is only ours. So that's probably, he at least claims that one father is more the father than the other.
My guest is Volker Schlondorf, who has directed many films. But we're talking about his Oscar winner, The Tin Drum, which has just been released in an expanded version. It opens today at the Film Forum. Also, a documentary that has never been seen in its full version called Billy, How Do You Do It? And that's going to be shown at the Film Forum on Sunday afternoon. So let's talk a bit about Billy Wilder.
First, the title, you know, in his office. I mean, we were friends. He kind of, you know, had a look back into Germany and, you know, German film culture and so where he had grown up. So he was interested what's going on over there. And when I had done Last Honor of Katharina Blum, he wrote me a letter, didn't know him then, and he thought it was fabulous, whatever, even was even up to Fritz Lang's M. But the thing is, in his office,
You have to mention that you ignored his fan letter, and he got very annoyed with
you. Well, what do you do? How can you answer a letter like this? I mean, I tried to. I drafted several responses. It was just too flattering to be true. And then I got a phone call and he from his agent saying that they were both in Munich. It was to shoot Fedora, and that I should come over to Mr. Wilder and apologize for not having answered his letter. And that's how our friendship started.
And what was it? What was the sign in his office?
And the sign in his office is like in a nice Saul Steinberg kind of writing, how would Lubitsch have done it? And that was, he said, that is the question in every situation in staging and screenwriting. He was wondering. So I turned it around. Billy, how did you do it?
Now, and you talk a lot about other German directors who came to America. Lubitsch was his god, but also Murnau was a major figure.
Yeah, he made a difference between those who came like around 1927. He said this was the vague of the talented emigrants. You know, they only left because of their talent. Then in 1933 came all those, you know, who were fleeing from the Nazis.
not a bad group. Fritz Lang, Fred Zinnemann, Edgar G. Ulmer, Douglas Sirk.
Yeah, and Billy Wilder.
But he didn't respect them as much. He's a lot harder on Fritz Lang than I ever would be.
Yeah, well, that I think was more a question of character than of the movies, because I'd say that when it comes to film noir and you see Double Indemnity, that owes a lot to Fritz Lang. But Fritz Lang was never popular, not even when they were in Germany. You know, he had sort of a very arrogant attitude towards everybody, even though he lived at the end quite miserably in Hollywood.
Because he couldn't get any assignments.
In those days, there was no DGA residuals and stuff. You know, he literally lived from giving an interview from time to time for $500.
Wow, despite the fact that many people considered him one of the greatest living directors.
But there were no residuals, yeah.
He also speaks to you in German a lot, despite the fact
Billy,
he lived
in
the United States for so long.
Well, that is was just, I mean, first of all, he enjoyed meeting friends like me so he could practice his German, which was actually kind of a wonderful mix of Viennese and Berlin, which doesn't even fit together. But like his English, you know, it was really a radio language since we are in radio here, because like he learned English from listening to American radio, and he was a reporter in Berlin before coming here. So he had all these wonderful, you know, expressions and idioms and talking fast. And so he enjoyed whatever the punchline was. You know, we just switched from German to English to see wherever it worked best.
You've adapted a number of novels to film, Young Turles, The Handmaid's Tale, The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, Tin Drum. He said that he thought that wasn't a good idea to adapt novels.
He said, why don't you always take novels? You
had he done any novels?
Not that I know of, because he believed so much in... Yes, Lost Weekend. Mm-hmm. That was kind of, you know, almost pulp fiction.
Which he forced through, according
yes.
to his story.
Yeah, yeah. He really believed very strongly into this little paperback he bought on the train station in Chicago, going, you know, on the 20th century from L.A. to New York. And arriving in New York, he called Mr. Bennett, Charles Brackett, yes, his screenwriter, and I said, why don't you get a copy of that book? I think it would make a great movie. But other than that, he believed that plays were better source material for a movie. Even Viennese plays and whatever he used, Hungarian plays, because he said, look, you already got your three-act structure, and you know at some moment the curtain comes up, and at another point he has to come down, and within these 90 minutes you got to tell your story. How can you ever do that with a novel?
It's interesting when you look at his career, because some of his films are among the most American I can think of, like Sunset Boulevard, Some Like It Hot, Double Indemnity, The Apartment, and then he did all of those films about Germany, going back to right after the war.
Of all the immigrants, he was the only one to ever go back. But just to shoot, I mean, he was interested to see what becomes of the country. Sorry, I interrupted
no,
you.
No.
Foreign
no.
Affair.
That was
but
the first
he
one.
Had worked as
Stalag,
you know,
17,
still,
1, 2, 3.
Absolutely, and he had worked on when he was still in the army on a documentary about the camps called "The Mills of Death," which very few people know. Which was 12 years before Night and Fog by Alain René. It was really the first. So actually what he did was the editing of the footage that had been taken either by Russian or by the Allied cameraman.
And then he relates that he showed it in German theaters and people walked out.
Well, he did a preview as if it was a Hollywood movie in Würzburg. And they handed out pencils and paper so that people could, you know, write down some notes and their impressions. And he said when the screening was over, nobody was left in the theater. All the pens and pencils were stolen. So he went to see the general, and General Clay, I guess it was at the time, and he said, why don't we force the Germans to see the movie and to get a stamp when they have seen it before they get food stamps? But the general thought it was not too coercive a re-education and dropped that idea. Simply the audience was not ready in the fall of 1945. Those who survived, whether they were criminals or not, they also had lived through the war. So the horror was too close. They couldn't cope with it.
Could that film be shown now?
Oh, yes. I think sometimes it's shown. It is, Alain René, when he did Night and Fog, the interesting thing is between the documents, you know, of the camps or what they found when they opened the camps, he put in long shots, of color footage he shot along the fences and the Birkenau and the things and so on. So that sometimes you can breathe a bit and then you go back into the world of the documentary, of the immediacy of the horror. And Billy's is very close. It's almost like a newsreel editing.
But it's obviously a film by an outraged man.
Absolutely. No, I mean, the amazing thing is, you know, that he, the comedy man from Hollywood, you know, would do that and be so outraged. And he had good reason, since his whole entire family perished except a brother of his who was also in Hollywood making movies, which few people know.
Now, you lived in France.
That's right,
for
yeah.
much of your career. Did you go into exile from
Germany? No, not at all. I was 16 when I volunteered to go 2 months to France to learn French, you know, like what a nice adventure this would be rather than to attend classes. And then, indeed, it was such a discovery. I mean, coming from a small town in Germany, Wiesbaden, ending up in a French Jesuit school of all, It was a whole new world, and I just liked that better than being at home. It was the the first adventure out into the world, and in a sense, I never came home.
Well, do you think that your films are as much French films as they are German films?
Well, that's what the French say or some Germans say. I don't really know. I mean, whatever language you speak, or if I do the Death of a Salesman in New York, or if I do Proust in Paris, somehow, of course, it's this question of the identity. Somehow there is something in your culture that always remains and can be seen, like in Billy Wilder's American films, like The Apartment. There is a touch of Berlin in it.
Berliners had this kind of a wit that, what is it called, Berliner Schnauze or something?
Schnauze, yeah.
Were you surprised when it turned out that Günter Grass had been conscripted into the SS and had
that he had lied so long about it? And whenever we talk, I mean, the subject comes up. I mean, after all, I knew him, known him for 20 years before I learned that, and we had been working very closely together, because after the Tin Drum, we worked on two original screenplays, which were not good enough to become movies, apparently. But so we are very, very close, and we traveled in the world a lot. And he said, yeah, but look, I tried to tell this, you know, in the mid-50s, nobody wanted to know, so I dropped it. And then how could I ever come back to it? This has been the demon working in him and pushing him then to write all these great novels. He still had to cope with this, and it was just never the right moment to say so.
You talked about doing follow-ups to the Tin Drum because the whole story hadn't been told, and you wanted to go to the...
To the fall of the wall for whatever period. I mean, we were working with Günter Grass quite soon after
is that
the
totally
first
dead?
Part. It's totally dead, because by now even our actor is 44 and it wouldn't make sense anymore. No, we simply never could convince producers that the second part, the post-war years and so on, would be interesting. Personally, I still love that project. I can screen that picture in my mind at night.
Just one more thing. Billy, How Did You Do It? Is being shown in its complete form. Billy Wilder didn't like the complete version, did he?
Well, he was adamant against it in some way. Finally gave it to be shown in Europe. He said, like, what do I care what people think about me? He was embarrassed by his appearance, by his nonchalance, you know, scratching his back, sweating, chewing gum, answering the phone at the same time, swiveling around in his chair, speaking with his hands. All that he resented when he saw it. It didn't feel dignified enough to him. I guess it didn't feel dignified enough to Audrey Wilder, his wife, either. He just did not want it to be shown. He said, look how I'm sweating. You know, this is what in Hollywood we have makeup people for. You know, they would have put a little powder on my face. But the good thing, this one is without powder.
And you can see it on Sunday at the Film Forum at 1 o'clock. The Tin Drum starts today, and you're going to be at the Film Forum?
Yes, I'll come to both venues and do Q&A and introduction and bath in the glory. No, I mean, it's such a privilege that, you know, a film you made a quarter of a century ago has a rerun in a theater. I mean, what a lucky bastard I am.
And it feels different because we have had all of that time in between to think about these things.
Yeah.
It doesn't shock as much, but it kind of... explains
well,
I think if
it's vivid and alive, that's all I ask for, not only in the colors, but vivid in the characters and in the emotions.
Thank you so much for being with us, Volker Schlondorf.
Thank you.